Queridos hermanos y hermanas, dear friends, if ever there was a familiar gospel passage almost known by heart for most of us, it probably would be this gospel. Well, maybe we could argue a little bit because Bethlehem's story of the manger might be a favorite for lots of people. But anyway, this is a very important gospel, and so it comes so regularly during the Easter season that we almost know it by heart. And because it's so familiar, it's helpful to take a very close look at something that we know so well. I take the reader's guide, and I pencil in hand, and I just go through the text, and I underscore or highlight all the phrases that are repeated, and suddenly out of the text comes a pattern that I hadn't seen before. It's just there in a new and fresh way. It's the evening of the first day of the week, Easter Sunday. Not just the beginning of a new week, but the eighth day of creation, in a sense. Almost as if Holy Week, with the Passion and the Lord's Supper, all of that, were the work of a new creation, and then the eighth day is the beginning of putting all of that new creation to work. A time to put things together in order to be of service to a world in a new way. So, the first day of the week, the eighth day of creation, new creation, is a time to sustain the world around us, to develop it, to deepen it, to coordinate, cooperate together, all our gifts, in order to work together in a new and helpful way. I mean, it's the first day. It's the eighth day. They were locked in the upper room from the inside. They were locked in the upper room out of fear. They were locked in the upper room out of protection. They didn't know what to expect from the hostile forces out there somewhere. They were closed in on themselves by shock and sorrow and shame. They were overcome by a certain sense of guilt and recrimination, embarrassment. It's hard, difficult to imagine the range and depth of emotions in that upper room, the men and women who were there after the Lord's death, and then suddenly this wonderment. They were second-guessing themselves, no doubt. That would be the human response. They were second-guessing each other. Had they seen it coming? Should they have seen it? Could they have prevented it? Was it somehow their fault? Whether they had run away or betrayed or denied, was it somehow their fault? And in the middle of all of that, smack in the middle, stands the risen Lord with all that emotion. And he says, "Peace be to you." Shalom. Or in Greek, Irene. Peace be to you. It's biblical peace that we're talking about. I say that frequently, but in this case, it's all the more important to lift it up for us to ponder. It's biblical peace. It's not the way in which we use that phrase so often in our own daily life, like the kids are finally in bed, they're asleep, finally peace and quiet in the house. Or the neighboring rock band has stopped practicing in the garage, finally peace and quiet. No, this is biblical peace. It's putting everything back together in a new way. Putting things back into relationship the way they should be. I like to make reference to a phrase in modern Hebrew. When you repay a loan, you borrowed money from someone and you repay it, you eshelem it. You put it back into wholeness in someone else's purse and pocket. It's restoring things back to the way they should be, pieces put together. So it's the jigsaw puzzle after you finally put the middle pieces together, and it's all together, the whole picture is there, that's biblical peace. Or an automobile engine that is smoothly tuned and every part is doing its proper function so that it's running well, smoothly, that's biblical peace. Makes noise, but it's biblical peace. Or perhaps a basketball play that has been practiced and practiced and practiced, and suddenly it's pulled off flawlessly. because every person is doing what he or she is supposed to do. That's biblical peace. So when Jesus stands in the midst of that troubled community, that divided, deeply divided, troubled community, and says to them, "Peace be to you," it's a new sense of unity. Now, last year, it struck me for the first time, and I come back to it again today, that's repeated three times. And not only is it repeated three times, but in each case, it is to a different situation, which we need to understand because it's part of our Easter mission. First of all, to those who were locked in from the outer world for fear, Jesus says, "Peace be to you," which has in itself an implicit command to get out back integrated in the community, not to stand apart, not to run away from difficulties, to acknowledge whatever is out there, and not to be afraid to say, "I'm sorry," to say what needs to be said, whether it's appreciated or not, to take blame for things that we have done or not done. Biblical peace in that first instance is to open the doors and deal with the larger community because, as a matter of fact, because of Easter, we have something to contribute to that larger community by way of healing, by way of understanding, by way of growth, spiritual growth. Not to run away, but to be there. Peace be to you. Open the door. Get out there. And the second one is to the community, because it's immediately followed by the promise of forgiveness of sins. And the hinge between those two is Jesus showing his wounds. So on the one hand, those wounds were received from that community out there, and they need to be healed as well. And they also were a way of identifying with the wounded Christian community that doesn't know what to make of things. So the second "peace be to you" is to the community, to forgive each other, to learn how to live with the recognition of the limits, the weakness, the flaws, to offer God's gift of forgiveness so that they can come together as a community again, as an organic community. Each one of them having something to contribute, distinctive, so that the whole community might be a sign of God's grace at work. And then the third time, to Thomas, who wasn't there the first time, to Thomas, who somehow, at least as I read the text and think about it and pray about it, to someone one who represents the future, another generation out there, not to be content with just dealing with the present moment, but the call, the summons to be united with generations to come who have not seen, who are called to believe, to learn the languages that are necessary to communicate, to understand the cultures still to come outside of our own. Three times "peace be to you" is a summons then. In one sense, it's three different approaches to community, or better, it's three different communities which God's grace, risen grace, brings into being, to which the disciples of the risen Lord are sent. Not only do each of those communities need us, but we need them. Human beings are social by design. We grow into a family, born into a family, and gradually as we mature, we in a sense move into ourselves and move into a different community. That's part of adolescence. You've got to say, "This family of mine, I'm a little embarrassed to go shopping with them, so I'd rather be with my friends in the mall." I mean, it's part of growing in, but it's always with a community. We need friends. As we mature, we look for a spouse, perhaps, or we look for that circle of friends whom we know and love, who love us enough to tell us the truth. We need that. They need us. We need them. All of gifts, all of God's gifts and talents are never just for ourselves. They're always for others by God's design. I like to quote Desmond Tutu, that wonderful Archbishop of South Africa, who was an instrumental figure in reconciliation, in the destruction of apartheid, and in dealing with the tragedy of all of that. He said at least once, the totally self-sufficient person is subhuman. That's a wonderful phrase. The totally self-sufficient person is subhuman. To be fully human is to recognize the need we have for other people, for what they can contribute to our lives and for what we can contribute in a sense of true fulfillment to the lives in the larger world around us. The radical individualism of our culture, as I think about it this past week, is in a very real sense a mild form of mental illness. It really is. It's a spiritual malaise where we think that we're somehow the center of everything, and what we want and what we choose to do, when we want it, etc., without consideration for the consequences to the larger common good. That's an illness. It's a spiritual malaise. It has serious consequences. People talk about the growing incidence of depression in people's lives. Adolescent suicides, it's a growing number. Those are realities in our culture, and they need to trouble us deeply because we're called to care about each other. The powerful antidote is really the Eucharist. We had that first reading of the community, the idealized community, but the Eucharist is also an antidote. Just as they say, and with good reason, that the Our Father is the perfect prayer, namely it contains absolutely everything that is necessary for good prayer: community, relationship, transcendence, forgiveness, nourishment, protection. Just as the Our Father is the perfect prayer, so the Eucharist is in fact the perfect experience of adult Christian spirituality. Everything is there that needs to be there, or here that needs to be here. There used to be a spaghetti sauce that had an ad, which I always smiled at, because they'd say, everything is there. Mushrooms, they're there. Basil, it's there. Tomato, it's there. But the Eucharist, you know, it's everything that we need for spirituality, for adult Christian spirituality is here. It's community. It's mercy. It's speaking to needs and asking us to sort those needs out from our wants, because there's a difference. Presenting the Word of God. Nourishment, prayer for the whole world, a mission. We come together in the Eucharist, the phrase, you know, see you at Mass, it's not a clever phrase only. It really is right on target. And it enables us, when we come together, to deal with our own inadequacies and our own failures and our own limitations, moral, intellectual, physical, every which way, and to be inspired again to be sent out to the larger community, peace be to you, to the forgiveness within us, peace be to you, to future generations, peace be to you. We're practicing Catholics. And the Eucharist is part of a practicing Catholic, because keep praying at it all life long. Figure out how we can do it and do it well. Deacon Tom Hunt, here with us today, and I are back in the confirmation circuit again. Last night, we were at St. Matthias on the south side of the city. This afternoon, we're out at Muskegon. I'm reading letters again. 60 last night, 80 today. And I am really fascinated by the way in which these letters today, now this year, last year, talk about the importance of the Eucharist that they have discovered as young adults in a new way. Saying, I used to be dragged, didn't want to go, my parents made me go. And somehow in the process of preparation for confirmation, I am understanding how important this is for my life. Well, I know. Read enough of these letters. I know they say things that they think I want to hear. But also they say some powerful things. A reminder of the importance of the Eucharist and community, that it nourishes and inspires us and empowers. and sends us out in the name of the risen Lord to say to a larger world, because God has empowered us to say it, peace be to you.